You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. The feast is upon us, right? Hoping your travels and preparations are proceeding well or that everything came off without a hitch. How did the gravy turn out? We've got an hour of gravy for you. Conversations with women. One woman whose husband did all the cooking while he was alive, feminist pioneer and Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, would have let Martin D. Ginsburg, her tax lawyer and foodie husband, handle the turkey today, no doubt, in that household. A wide-ranging conversation with the Associate Justice coming up. This hour, women voices nowhere near the oven or the stove will relive some great conversations over the last year. Pioneers all, great talkers all. Just imagine some of these women sitting beside you while you slice the onions or try to find the exit off the interstate. I've got to get a bird in the oven myself right now. I'm the chief cook in my house, although my wife gets a veto on something that promises to be too much of a mess. And we've got a raft of potlucky relatives descending on us this year, so for me, the pressure is off. We begin this hour with Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who spoke with me for nearly an hour a few months back. The court was not in session, but Ginsburg's comments on the dynamics of the Roberts Court were candid and lively. She took us into the arguments that she propounded as a legendary litigator, as a young lawyer and law professor, arguments that became a doctrine in laws and decisions eliminating discrimination on the basis of gender. But like a true pioneer and lover of the Constitution, with modesty, Ginsburg insisted that any doctrine against discrimination she helped develop in the supreme law of the land was already there.
I didn't change the Constitution. The equality principle was there from the start. I just was an advocate for seeing its full realization. The Declaration of Independence starts out, all men are created equal. So I see my advocacy as part of an effort to make the equality principle everything the founders would have wanted it to be if they weren't held back by the society in which they lived, and particularly the shame of slavery. So I don't think my efforts would have succeeded had it not been for the women's movement that was reviving in the United States and more or less all over the world at the time. And the court was certainly aware of that sea change in what the public thought women ought to be doing. A great constitutional law scholar, Paul Freund, once said, "The court should never be influenced by the weather of the day, but inevitably they will be influenced by the climate of the era." And that's what happened in the 1970s. Judges had daughters and granddaughters, and they began to recognize that some of the so-called favors for women were not favors at all, but they were locking women into a small piece of man's wide world. So it was the change in society that opened the court's eyes and made my arguments palatable when they would not have been a generation before.
Would you say today that climate is technology and privacy law and the changes that are taking place in the way people communicate and how that affects the First Amendment and law enforcement and the Fourth Amendment, for instance?
Yes, there are just a host of problems spawned by the electronic age, things we couldn't even conceive of. I was amused by the analogy that Justice Scalia made in a case about a GPS tracker. So you don't know that's being done to your car. Is that a violation of your right to protection against unreasonable searches and seizures? So Justice Scalia imagined a constable clinging to the bottom of a carriage as it went on its way. So there was some notion that there is an official eye that's on you, but you don't know about it. Yes, there are all kinds of challenges. And as de Tocqueville said, sooner or later, in the United States, every controversy ends up in court. I think that says great things about our judicial system, or even the cases that I brought. Take the very first one, Sally Reed, who attacked an Idaho statute that said, as between persons equally entitled to administer a decedent's estate, males must be preferred to females. Well, Sally wanted to administer the estate of her 17-year-old son, who was a suicide, when he was staying with his father. He took one of his father's many rifles and killed himself. And the father put in an application, and the probate judge said, Sally, the law tells me what I must do. Even though you filed first, males must be preferred to females. That woman, who made her living by caring for elderly and infirm people in her own home, she thought that a wrong had been done to her and that the legal system would make it right. So she brought that case with a lawyer from Boise, Idaho, through three levels of the Idaho courts. Every one of the plaintiffs in the cases that I litigated in the 70s was just like that, an everyday person who thought that they had experienced a wrong. The courts would make it right. It says a lot about the federal judiciary.
Who do you think, in your view, are better at deciding when it's time to quit? Opera singers or justices?
I don't like to pigeonhole people or give categorical answers. There are some singers that know exactly when to go, and others hang on much too long. And that is the same with judges. My own view, and I've said this many times, is as long as I can do the work full steam, I will stay on the court. But when I feel myself slipping, when I forget the names of cases that I once could recite at the drop of a hat, I will know.
So many people in America today think of the American government, the legislature, the executive, the presidency on some level, our political system, to be broken or frustratingly divided and incapable of moving forward on issues of our day. Lots of people describe that as the government being broken. People did not describe the judiciary as being broken. What's it like to work in an institution in a frustrating moment in the history of Washington that does work, an institution that absolutely carries out its mission and does what it's supposed to do?
One aspect of appellate judging is we have to give reasons for all of our decisions. And when you sit down and try to write it out, sometimes you find that your first judgment wasn't the right one. And to make the institution work, people have to put aside their own egos and work for the good of the court. We all revere this institution, and we all want to leave it in as good shape as we found it. The current court is unusually collegial. You might not get that impression from some of the 5-4 decisions, but they surely are. That has not always been so. When Justice Brandeis was appointed by President Wilson, his immediate predecessor, McReynolds, also a Wilson appointee, would leave the room when Brandeis spoke because he was an out-and-out anti-Semite. The year Brandeis joined the court, there was no group photograph. McReynolds refused to stand next to Brandeis. So there have been times, there have been justices who just didn't get along with each other, but there's none of that on this court. We all respect and even like each other.
As a justice, you question lawyers quite a lot during oral arguments, and you have a reputation for doing that. I sometimes wonder if, as a litigator yourself, you yearn to get out there and argue the case for some of the lawyers, that you miss that litigating experience, even though you obviously are happy to be a justice.
I'm more than content with my current position. I do ask questions. I think we have an obligation to put to the lawyers the points on which we think the case may turn, so they have their best shot at answering. I suppose I'm about middle in the number of questions I ask. I'm not as active as some of my colleagues. The court of the 1970s didn't ask as many questions as the current court does. And sometimes I can understand a lawyer's resentment that the court is eating up his or her time with too many questions.
What's it like coming to the court after having been a litigator before the court who has a relationship with the justices that suddenly you're serving next to?
I had a middle period. I was for 13 years on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, so I had already made the transition from advocate to judging. It's great to be in the position of asking questions and not having to answer questions. I know many a lawyer would like to respond to our question with another question, but that's not cricket.
Finally, your late husband was a chef, I understand. I'm the chef in my house. I often have thought, and this came up in some of my readings about you, I've often thought that if anything happened to me, would my wife get the right kind of food, get someone to cook for her? Assure me that if the chef were to leave, someone would take care of my wife.
I nominate your 15-year-old daughter. I have a daughter who is now 58. But when she was about your daughter's age, she noticed a big difference between daddy's cooking and mommy's cooking. Up until then, I was the everyday cook. Marty cooked on weekends and whenever we had company. So my daughter, who genuinely loves good food, made Marty. She gave him sole command of the kitchen. And so for all the years I've lived in D.C., and now it's over 30, I have never cooked a meal. When Marty died, Jane took it upon herself to come every month, spend one day with me, spend the whole day cooking, fill my freezer, and so I continue to be very well fed.
You hear that, Zoe? Justice Ginsburg, thank you so much for a delightful afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We are certainly thankful that she sat down with us this year.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Our next voice is also on the law. She sees the criminal justice system not from the bench of the highest court in the land, but from the rough and tumble level of residents of the poorest congressional district in the nation, the South Bronx. Robin Steinberg is founder and director of the Bronx Defenders, a nonprofit that represents criminal defendants with no other access to lawyers. Steinberg says her clients may be relatively powerless and without means, but they often have a sophisticated knowledge of just how the justice system is stacked against them.
Leveling the playing field is simply impossible. Defender offices across this country are under-resourced. Prosecutors' offices, quite frankly, are under-resourced. Everybody's under-resourced in the criminal justice system. And so there's not really a leveling of the playing field. What you really have is the defender is the one person who stands up beside the person charged with a crime and speaks on his or her behalf and tries to put in context what the charge is and that particular act and tries very, very hard to fight against an entire system that is attempting to define that person in his or her entirety by that act. So we're the people sort of saying, look, even if this happened, let's look at the context. Let's look at this person's humanity. Let's look at their personal life. Let's look at their family. Let's look at their community with the hope that we can find some mitigation, that we can convince people to respect people's humanity and dignity through the process and can arrive at something that feels relatively fair.
Do you resent people like me and others, you know, talking about level playing fields and making these abstract kinds of statements about the criminal justice system working?
I don't resent it. I get frustrated sometimes by it. I get enraged a little bit by it. But at the end of the day, the value that we sort of really hope to hold is to educate the public about what's really going on in the criminal justice system. And I recognize that for people that live in more affluent communities, this is off the radar screen, that it's hard to believe. Most people that I tell these stories to find it hard to believe.
So people talk about slippery slopes, but you see just a big ledge and a drop-off.
I see a ledge and a drop-off in lots of ways in the criminal justice system. I mean, the thing that's most bizarre in some ways to me is for the past 20 years you have watched crime drop significantly in New York City and, frankly, across this country. And yet you see arrest numbers continue to go up. You would have expected to see the downsizing of prisons, the downsizing of jails, the downsizing of public defender offices, prosecutors' offices, and courthouses. And instead what you see is they have replaced arresting people who are charged with crime with really charging people with criminalization of behavior that's only criminalized in certain neighborhoods. By that I mean graffiti, trespass, sitting on a stoop and drinking a beer. Those are the kinds of things now that people are getting picked up for in certain communities, but not in other communities.
So I'm going to magically transform myself from the naive person who doesn't really understand what's going on the front lines, as you see it, to a judge. I give you the power to pluck somebody from the system over the last 30 years that if you had the power, you could just pull them out and send them on their way. Is there someone you would do? You would pluck from the system? You would reach in and get?
There are thousands and thousands of people that I would pluck from the system. I think there are thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of people whose cases never should have been brought at all, where the behavior that's been criminalized could have been resolved in a different way. You see it particularly in school-age high school kids. The fight in the playground between two kids that in my generation would have been resolved with a principal and a parent being called in or a principal and a caregiver being called in, the police get called. Writing on a desk in school, which I have to admit and probably on advice of counsel I shouldn't, I did as a child all the time. Writing on a desk in a public school in a neighborhood like the South Bronx can result in an arrest for criminal mischief, and we see those cases all the time. And that experience affects your life, particularly if you're a young person. Yes, there's the stigmatizing of a criminal conviction or the actual ramifications and collateral consequences of a conviction that could happen to you and your family. But the experience of being thrown up against a wall, being handcuffed, being talked to in a rough and vulgar way by the police, being thrown into the back of a car, taken to a precinct, locked in a cage, held there, brought underground to a criminal courthouse, sitting downstairs for 24 hours in a bullpen with 20 other men charged with anything from disorderly conduct to murder. That experience is not benign. That experience can really sear your soul and can, I think, affect particularly for young people the way they see themselves and the way they think the world sees them.
I have a 14-year-old daughter who very recently said with some real conviction, you know, what I want to do, Dad, is be a public defender.
That's awesome.
I know. It occurs to me to ask you, what tough lesson is she going to learn if she, you know, showed up at your office tomorrow?
She's going to learn that our society uses the criminal justice system in really onerous and destructive ways. She's going to see that it's unfair, grossly unfair. She's going to see that racism and classism basically permeate every single element of the criminal justice system in this country. She's going to see a lot of heartbreak, a lot of hardship. She's going to see poverty in ways that she's probably never seen it before. That having been said, she will see the incredible vibrancy and the incredible collaborative spirit of a community like the South Bronx. She'll see the clients who will come in and share their intimate stories and details with you, who you will frankly fall in love with and want to protect and want to help and want to stand in front of and want to empower to make their own decisions about what's important to them. And so there's a lot of hope in there, too, that she'll see.
For 30 years, you've been working in a system that you believe where the deck is stacked against you, yet you say you're lucky.
Incredibly lucky. I can't imagine doing any job that fulfills you the way that it does, that inspires in me the kind of passion that I feel for justice. It is a job that gives you way more than you're ever going to give it. And I feel like I've been lucky for 30 years to have that experience. I would recommend it to your daughter. I'd recommend it to anybody's daughter or son. We need more public defenders. We need more passionate people doing public defense. We need more people willing to look at the harsh realities of the criminal justice system and to really continue to get it out there into the world so that people like you and like other people who live in different kinds of communities and do different kinds of work really begin to understand and take it on as their own personal mission as well.
Robin Steinberg, Executive Director of the Bronx Defenders. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, if you don't escape the clutches of the justice system, you might end up wearing an orange prison jumpsuit, right? Orange is the New Black, a wry comment on prison reality, and the title of the hit Netflix show all about a women's prison and inmates and guards caught up in a world we rarely, if ever, get to see. One member of the cast is a pioneer in her own right as a performer. Laverne Cox is a transgender actress playing the transgender inmate, Sophia Bursette. Cox says her role in this series was an opportunity to convey a different kind of prison, how transgender people are just beginning a long journey to escape discrimination and intolerance in American culture.
I think this show exemplifies lots of women's stories that we don't get to see and hear a lot. I think it's a real depiction of one aspect of the American landscape, which is really important.
In the prison where the whites hang out is called the suburbs. So.
And where the blacks are, it's the ghetto.
Yeah.
It's funny, and I love that we're able to, and Gingy, our creator, talks a lot in her interviews about using humor to deal with some very intense and traumatizing situations. And I love the balance of humor with the intense drama in our show. Reading the scripts, I would sort of be laughing out loud to myself, and then I would just start burst out crying.
Well, there's a sense among the characters that they're struggling with I'm not really this. You're looking at me thinking I'm this, but I'm actually this. There's a real struggle with identity. Piper, for instance, is, I'm nice. I just made this one mistake 10 years ago. Or the woman, Cook, who's such a fascinating character, Red. I mean, she's, you know.
Yeah, the brilliant Kate Mulgrew.
Brilliant, yeah. And everyone wants you to think they're some way, but ultimately we can't control the way people think about us.
Well, I think in real life, there's always a disparity between how people often, not always, often a disparity between how we're perceived and who we really are in an authentic way. As a trans person, I often think about what it means to be authentic. And so much of being trans is about making the person you are on the inside match who the world sees on the outside. I believe that there is a universal humanity that we all have, that we all sort of ultimately want the same things. We want to be loved and accepted. And those elements are important to bring to every character. And for me as an artist, it's important for me to get in touch with my own sense of wanting to be loved and accepted and wanting to have connection and bring that to Sophia and whatever character I play.
You know, in many ways, the trans experience is unusual enough that it's not like people are going to go, that wasn't real. Oh, that was real. They're going to accept almost anything you say about sexuality as absolutely real. Maybe the trans community will, you know, write you some emails or something like that. But is it realism?
The piece that you just said that, like, we'll almost accept anything because we don't know is such an important piece, I think. It's such an important thing to point out because so often trans stories have been told in ways that sensationalize our identities, that objectify our bodies and sort of focus on transition and don't really have the human piece or the takeaway becomes all about surgery. What's exciting to me is that there's a lot of realism in terms of the real life lived experiences of trans people. A lot of trans folks are being denied hormones in prison, for example.
And that happens in this episode.
That happens in episode 3. And that real women like Sophia are dealing with that in prison right now. Real women are dealing with all levels of violence in prison. And really the response to Sophia and the response from the audience to the show in a lot of ways says it all. I feel like the public has been yearning and not honestly desperate, but like really wanting to have a show that they feel reflects them. I mean, specifically the trans folks who've written me have been so excited about Sophia and excited to see this character that's a little bit like them, that they can relate to in this sort of mainstream media context. And it's so important for folks to see folks who look like them and reflect their experiences because it's validating. And when folks can look look at the TV and say, this person knows what I've been through. It validates their experience. Mm. And it's a really powerful thing.
Laverne Cox, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. So who is someone you'd love to have with you right now? You need some help with the Brussels sprouts, maybe, or your three-year-old just wandered out into the rain, or maybe you want to have an adult conversation or talk to someone not family on this Thanksgiving Day. Well, meet Anne Desjardins, problem solver, trained hotel manager, single mother of three living in Boston. She joined us earlier this year along with several other strong women to share the comedy, tragedy, and difficulty of managing a household and a career. And oh boy, it is difficult.
I would have to agree with you. There's nothing easy about that.
Anne Desjardins is a hotel revenue management analyst and a single mother of three. Is that right?
That's correct.
You do some consulting on the side?
Some consulting on the side, yes.
When you, as a single mom, hear all the discussions from, you know, women executives, Sheryl Sandberg, the sort of lean in, lean out idea, what's your response to that?
I think it's fabulous. I think it's great to have that awareness out there. I just feel like not all of us have that luxury of being so vocal about it and what we want and expect in the workplace, because a lot of times that'll make or break your career.
So if you were to march into your boss's office and kind of lean into him or her and say, you know, I need 20% more. I'm a single mom. Come on. I'm trying to get a work-life balance here. What would be the response?
I think I'd be done.
Yikes.
Yes, I think that's just not... One thing I don't hide is the fact that I am a single parent. So my manager and my directors, I notice that they take that into consideration when they are working with me. And they see your drive. I don't have a luxurious life anywhere. All my time is work and motherhood. And I work with a lot of folks that are childless, and their career is everything. And I envy that. I envy that they get to take 100% time and just have their career flourish. I just don't have that luxury.
Well, let's say, not that you need anything else to do here, let's say you were going to write your Sheryl Sandberg book about the lessons of your life and give some advice to these young, childless, I dare say call them whippersnappers in your office who maybe need a little more experience but could benefit from yours. What advice would you give them if it was your book we were talking about here?
If I were to write my own book, it would really be to find the balance. It's not easy. You need to really find it and make this time count, because raising a child, I have 19, 18, and a six-year-old. And what I did with the older two was work, work, work. And I didn't take the time out to cherish simple moments, to take the kids away and just be amongst ourselves, to create those valuable memories. I see that's important.
So I hear you saying really, you know, cherish the time when your kids are growing up, but also choose your job on the basis of people who understand your honest situation and are going to treat you with some respect and give you some flexibility.
In a nutshell, it's not always that easy to choose the job, because remember, we're taking care of people, live people that need to eat, need to be sheltered, need to be clothed. So sometimes things are not working that great at work for us, and we need to stick through it. I have been working in the human resource industry for a very long time. I see that companies really do cherish the happiness of their employees. So when we are working and we're finding that work-life balance to be difficult, I think it's important to look for a happier ending.
Sounds like plenty of wisdom there, and certainly the wisdom of keeping an open conversation going about your real needs at home and on the job. Anne, thanks so much.
No problem. My pleasure.
Anne Desjardins, a hotel revenue management analyst and single mother of three. Good luck, Anne.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
women Supreme Court justices, pioneers, renegades, presidents, and vice presidents. On that score, we'll just have to dream or turn to television, where there have been numerous women commanders-in-chief and vice presidents in serious and not-so-serious roles. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is nobody's number two, but she plays Vice President Selina Meyer on the HBO series Veep. As a skilled actress with legendary comedic instincts, the lack of women models for vice president is kind of a problem. The fact that Geraldine Ferraro's story, she was Walter Mondale's running mate back in 1984, didn't have a lot of laughs, it kind of means Dreyfus was on her own here. For instance, she looks nothing like Joe Biden.
Well, that's a miracle.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, nothing against Joe Biden. I think he's great, but I'm glad to be a girl, for starters. Let's start with that.
And the great thing about the girl vice president, which is the sort of beginning premise of Veep, the HBO comedy, it's really, in many ways, the stories are all about trying to get access to number one and the frustrations that go with that. So in a sense, it's a very traditional kind of sitcom premise, but in a wonderfully different setting.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It feels like this sort of, when it was originally pitched to me, I thought, oh my God, I can't believe we're the first ones to ever think of this. But it's sort of perfect because it's second in command. It's powerful and yet powerless. It's a perfect setup for comedy.
And, you know, are you a public servant as a vice president, or are you just, you know, someone who really would rather be president?
Oh, I'm playing someone who would rather be president. I'm playing somebody who campaigned to be president and in the nomination process really came in third. And so, and then was asked to join the ticket after that. So she has grand aspirations for sure. This is not an end game for her by any means.
I love that you're so comfortable in the Washington milieu because it is so like show business. Have you ever thought of politics?
Well, not for myself, but I've thought a lot about politics, but not for me personally. I have, however. I'm very interested in politics in a different kind of way now that I'm playing this part. I mean, I really do enjoy watching things like C-SPAN and bits and pieces that you sort of catch, these in-between moments of all the leaders. I find it, the whole thing, fascinating.
We're talking with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who's a news junkie, we learn right here, actor star of the HBO comedy Veep. She's speaking to us from her shooting location in Baltimore, Maryland. Is that where you came up with the premise for the pregnancy episode, by mining C-SPAN and wondering what one or more of the characters you saw would look like pregnant?
No, we weren't thinking about what she looked like pregnant, but we were thinking about something that could come into play that would be devastating to her career-wise. And, of course, a pregnancy would be exactly that. And, you know, and here she is, and by the way, an unwanted pregnancy, and she's a single woman, et cetera, et cetera. So, and being given the news in a situation in which there were reporters and cameras around. But there are a lot of moments like this, these sort of, I mean, it was so much fun to watch even the debates and the presidential debates and the vice presidential debates, all of these platitudes and the way that, you know, the politicians sort of try to present themselves in a certain way. And it's all very understandable. It's after all, it's all very mineable for our show.
So, you know, we laughed at Lucy in television. We really rooted for Mary Tyler Moore as a woman in a position where she's going to make it after all. For Selina Meyer, are we rooting for her and women like her in this era of television, or is it more of we revel in their failures and imperfections, which might mirror some of the ways Hillary Clinton has been treated?
Yeah, I guess it is, although I will say that I don't think of it so much, and perhaps I should, I don't think of it really so much as a show about feminism and the glass ceiling as I think of it as a show about, I think of it as a, I think that a man in this position as vice president would have the same, if assuming it were a comedy, it would be the same kind of funny. You know what I mean? I think somehow it's the role of vice president and the fact that really there are only two constitutional duties that the vice president has, and beyond that, you're at the whim of the president. And the president might be a man or a woman. Now, maybe it's funnier if it is a woman. I'm not really sure. I haven't given it that much thought, and maybe I should, but I don't approach it that way. I approach it with anger.
Right. Well, I think, and certainly LBJ had tons of anger. Well, LBJ had plenty of anger about being vice president and about what a thankless position it was. And so many politicians have described just how awful it is to be vice president.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can imagine a woman doing almost anything in America today in terms of business success and high profile success in entertainment and in politics, but never been a woman vice president.
That's true. There's never been a woman vice president, and there haven't been a majority of women in Congress. And yeah, we've got a ways to go. But I would imagine that I certainly am hopeful that in my lifetime there will be maybe not a woman vice president, maybe even a woman president. It's not so far-fetched an idea, is it? I don't think so.
No, absolutely not.
So,
but the tension there, I think, drives some of the comedy. I think her pressure being first in this position, I think, drives some of the comedy.
Yeah, I think so, too. A lot of men telling her what to do and what she can't do, and that's infuriating, as well as the position itself is completely infuriating. The whole thing's infuriating, and understandably so.
Well, do you have a favorite vice president down through history, or anyone that you think might look really great in a dress?
Well, what do you think? I think LBJ would be heaven in a dress. What do you think? Heaven.
I'm with you. Agnew?
No, I think LBJ's got sort of a softer, maybe more, slightly more feminine look than Agnew, and it might have worked better in a dress. Bless his pea picking heart, as my Aunt Mimi would say.
Well, that's great. Congratulations on a great year and your Emmy.
Thanks a million. Yeah, really exciting. It's been a wild ride thus far, and I feel very lucky indeed.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus plays the Vice President of the United States, Selina Meyer, on the HBO show Veep. Now a story about a place between life and death, a real place, inhabited by a real man, Brooke Hopkins, who each day was faced with the decision, is his life worth living?
He has said, you can get used to anything, right? Those things, when he doesn't feel well, those things loom large, but when he does feel well, those things are just part of the way he is present in the world.
Those things for Peggy Batten, wife of Brooke Hopkins and distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of Utah, were details she shared with us about the remarkable and heartbreaking experience of caring for her husband. A once vibrant and energetic companion, a bicycle accident in 2008 made Peggy's husband a vibrant and energetic quadriplegic, able to do nothing on his own physically. His physical transformation and his struggle to survive brought to life, in a manner of speaking, Peggy's career spent advocating for patients' right to end their own lives. Peggy allowed us into her world of caregiving and shared her unexpected discovery, along with her husband, Brooke, that the value of life itself comes from something deep within, far beyond all of the many machines that were keeping him alive.
Respirators, machines, feeding tubes. Brooke has all those things. He has a feeding tube now. He has a cardiac pacer. He has a diaphragmatic pacer, which stimulates breathing. He has a ventilator, at least some of the time. But you know what? He has said, you can get used to anything, right? Those things, when he doesn't feel well, those things loom large. But when he does feel well, those things are just part of the way he is present in the world.
So many of the caregivers we've spoken with describe the experience as isolating sometimes, as a responsibility that is overwhelming. From your perspective, whose responsibility is the maintenance of Brooke's life? Is that his? Is that yours? Is it society's? Who does that hang on?
It seems to me caregiving at its best is a two-way street. The caregiver provides care for the patient, but the patient also cares about the caregiver. You try to think about what you need and want that will make voluntary caregiving, elective caregiving, caregiving you want to do, not that you have to do, possible. Work. Work is a very large part of my identity, I guess you'd say. So you can't give up something that's that central and be a care provider without resentment.
I'm wondering if you could talk about how at one moment Brooke decided to refuse care and how that ended up affirming this whole caregiving enterprise that you've been involved with for now the last 2 years.
Happened one afternoon. It happened to be April Fool's Day, just by coincidence. It was a gray, sort of late winter day. Spring just wasn't there, though it should have been. And Brooke had been saying that he wanted to die, that he wanted everything unplugged. And remember that a person has the legal right to discontinue therapy that is keeping them alive. I was there with a respiratory therapist, one we are very fond of, trust deeply. And we happened to be sitting there with Brooke in the living room, and he said, "I want to die. I want you to unplug everything right now." So we did. We unplugged the ventilator, took it off. We discontinued the supplementary oxygen, and his diaphragmatic pacer has an external battery pack that you can turn on and off. So we turned it off too and showed him that we had turned it off. So those three things were all deactivated. It was a very compelling moment. He sat in his chair in the living room, one of us on either side of him, and he sat as upright as he could manage, with his eyes closed. There didn't seem to be tears or agitation or anything. He appeared to be completely calm. And he sat there, and he sat there. And then after about 2 or 3 minutes that were among the longest minutes you can imagine, He opened his eyes. And he said, "Am I alive? Am I alive? I'm supposed to be dead." It took quite a while to convince him that he was really alive. "Am I dreaming?" he asked. "No, you're not dreaming. You're really alive." And his sense of disbelief, "I couldn't be alive. Everything was unplugged." As that dissipated and he realized that he really was alive, he said, "I'm so overjoyed. I'm so happy." He said he would never use a phrase like this normally, but he would. He said, "I'm a particularly happy camper." Right. So,
I guess I'm astounded at in this narrow-seeming space between whether you have a ventilator on or have a battery pack connected or not, and death, that you've managed to find such sort of dignity and pride in being independent, to being Brooke amidst all that machinery, and that that's some lesson about life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you can say that. We both try at this. We try to keep it from being a tragedy. We try to keep from thinking of it as a tragedy. We try to focus on those things that are really important. Walking isn't really important. It's convenient. But as you well know, one can have a full and rich life without walking. I think that's a good definition for caregiving. That is, recognizing that there are other ways to be in the world.
Margaret Peggy Batten is Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of Utah and caregiver to her husband, Brooke, Professor of English at the University of Utah. Thanks, Peggy.
Thanks.
A few weeks after speaking with us this year, Peggy's husband, Brooke, did decide to refuse the life support all around him and ended his life. Peggy was there for his last moments. And when we wrote our condolences to her, she replied in this way. I'm sad, extraordinarily sad, to lose Brooke, but caregiving for him was a privilege. Thanks to you for letting me talk about it on the air. We wish a peaceful and warm holiday to Peggy Batten. We are so thankful for what she gave us this year. Tomorrow on The Takeaway, our thanks go to you.
The closing line was, it's always been you. Mm-hmm. I'm the happiest person in the world right now. I have so much to be thankful for. I have a wonderful wife who's a true partner. Everything is fun.
We have a lot of fun. Yeah.
From Sweethearts Reunited to a lifetime of tough conversations with God.
When I was 20, could I have imagined that I would have been Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and married an Episcopal priest? No. But now that I'm here, I really can't imagine being anywhere else.
These are all stories you have shared with us, adding to and really making The Takeaway's voice. We couldn't do it without you.
The appreciation, it's very nice to have, but I think that overall, she would have done the same without hesitation.
So tune in tomorrow and find out who he is talking about and how a mom's wisdom was passed to a very special and loyal son. Stories from you all coming up tomorrow on The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great Thanksgiving. And remember, when you make the gravy, let the flour cook in the butter long enough. I'm telling you, it's going to be lovely. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.